Okay, we are back in session again. Good morning. We are now constituted as the full Air Board. And let's begin by having Marcy call the roll once again, and then we'll do the Pledge of Allegiance.
On the roll for the Board of Directors meeting of February 1st, 2017, Director Avalos, Director Barrett.
Here.
Director Canepa.
Here.
Director Chavez, Director Cutter, Director Joya,
here.
Director Groom,
present.
Director Haggerty, Director Kaplan,
here.
Director Kim, Director Marr, Director Miley, Director Mitchoff, Director Pepper, Director Ju, Director Ross, Director Sanchez, Director Sinks, Director Sparing, Director Wagon Connect, Director Zane, Secretary Rice,
here.
Vice Chair Hudson.
Here.
Chair Niss.
Here.
We have a quorum.
Thank you very much. I think Director Ross is here and probably will be out in just a minute. So before we even do the pledge, just so they can take part in it fully, let me welcome Mayor Pauline. Is it Russo Cutter? Do you use it hyphenated?
I don't hyphenate it, so it's just Cutter.
Okay, good. From San Leandro, and you are the mayor, and congratulations on being selected to serve.
Well, thank
and
you.
It's a pleasure to have you.
Pleasure to be here.
And second, we have Mayor Pete Sanchez over there from Suisun City, and it's a pleasure to have you as well, also as the mayor. So, greetings, and we're delighted to have you join our group. There are roughly 24 of us, or usually, I think we may be 22 at the moment until two more are appointed. So with that, Dave, why don't you lead us in the Pledge of Allegiance?
Please stand. I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Thank you, and that takes us to public comment on non-agenda items. Do we have any cards for that, Marcy?
I have Mr. Tom Lewis, who requested to speak.
Okay, would that person step forward?
Madam Chair, how many minutes?
We can give three. Things look reasonably quiet for this morning.
That's what you say for now.
Yes. Good morning. And if there's anyone else under public comment on non-agenda matters, if you would come forth now. Good morning.
Good morning. To paraphrase a well-known civil rights leader, greetings, brothers and sisters, friends and enemies. Because in a meeting of this nature, there are many enemies. I'm Tom Lewis from the Vine Hill neighborhood, east of Martinez. We are the very definition of an impacted community. As the second vice president of East County NAACP and in the spirit of protecting impacted communities and promoting social equity from your clean air plan, I once again extend an invitation to you to join East County NAACP in Antioch at the Lone Tree Golf Event Center on April 22nd for our 60th anniversary banquet celebration. Short of passing the proposed regulations, there are a few better ways to demonstrate your commitment to the most impacted communities. Thank you very much.
Thank you for speaking. Anyone else on this non-agenda topic? Okay, we will continue on then. Our next item is the consent calendar, numbers 3 to 5. Is there any question or any comment on the consent calendar? And if not, could I have a motion?
Second.
Any discussion? If there is no discussion and no dissension, let's move forward on to committee reports. which is number 6, and that will be a report of the Budget and Finance Committee meeting that took place January 25th, and Carol Groom is the chair.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The committee met on Wednesday, January 25th, 2017, and approved the minutes of December 16, 2016, with an amendment made by Director Mischoff regarding the incorrect date of the next committee meeting. The committee reviewed and discussed the presentation Air District Financial Audit Report for fiscal year ending 2016, then reviewed and discussed the staff presentation Second Quarter Financial Report fiscal year ending 2017. Finally, the committee reviewed and discussed the staff presentation overview of current fiscal year ending 2017. The next meeting of the Budget and Finance Committee will be held Wednesday, February 22, 2017, 9:30 a.m. at the Bay Area Air Quality Management District. This concludes the report of the Budget and Finance Committee.
Do we need a recommendation to approve that? Okay, then we move on from there to the Air District Financial Audit Report. There is none. And we go on to the Second Quarter Financial Report, also none. And then an overview of the fiscal year ending 2017. And I show that there is none at this point, no report meaning. And so we'll receive and file as we did with the other two. Any comments on that? So if not, we move on to the report of the Mobile Source Committee, and that is you, Chair Mischoff.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The committee met on Thursday, January 26, 2017, and approved the minutes of December 15, 2016. The committee reviewed and discussed the staff presentation, projects and contracts with proposed grant awards over $100,000. The committee recommends the board approve the Carl Moyer program projects with proposed grant awards over $100,000 as shown in Attachment 1, and the authorization of the executive officer to enter into agreements with applicants for the recommended projects. The committee then reviewed and discussed the staff presentation overview of transit and shuttle trends in the Bay Area. And finally, the committee reviewed and discussed the staff presentation update efforts to further reduce emissions at the Port of Oakland. The next meeting will be held on Thursday, February 23rd, here in this building at 9:30. And before I move the recommendations, and Mr. Miley isn't here yet, but Mr. Haggerty and Mr. Hudson.
No, Mr. Miley is here.
Oh, hello.
He's coffee.
Oh, we had a discussion about wanting to express our request to Director Gioia, as he sits on CARB, to really advocate up in Sacramento for, and I'm looking to my fellow committee members because I'm drawing a blank, but Nate, come on out. You were the one that said, let's make sure we
I'm listening. I'm all ears.
Rebecca was there, too.
Yeah. May I?
Yes.
Well, I know there were multiple items we discussed, but one of them was wanting in the next round of state legislation to increase the amount of funding that comes through our board, which we then give out through the vehicle fee. I don't know if you were thinking of that item or
Nate says
a different
that's
one.
It.
But we did discuss wanting to advocate at the state level that we currently get a small portion of that vehicle fee, that we then give out through TFCA, if I'm recalling correctly, and that we wanted to request more
so
in pending state legislation.
That's our request. And so with that, I
Thank
will
you.
Move the Mobile Source Committee's recommendations.
Is there a second? Okay. And any dissension on that? If there is none, that passes, and we move on to the Stationary Source Committee. Chair John Gioia.
Thank you.
And let me just thank him ahead of time because he had an extensive meeting on Monday, and I know they were here for quite some time. John?
We had 50 very engaged members of the public speak. Jack, do you want me to give the report out after or before the presentation that your staff is giving?
Well, good morning.
So maybe your staff gives a brief presentation.
Right. I thought it would be appropriate for us to give a presentation, if you all don't mind, about essentially which was the only item that the Stationary Source Committee.
So maybe what I'll just say then briefly is that, so the board has this context, is that you the staff made a presentation to the stationary source on the status of rules 1216 and 1118 and the addition of new rule 13.1, which is a refinery carbon intensity cap. And the report out is that you're on time with bringing rule 1116 and 1216 and 1118 to the board in May, and the expected time frame for 13.1 is July. And I can add more, but just that context as
so
you
if
start.
If I could, Madam Chair and members of the board, and specifically for Directors Cutter and Sanchez, just to give you a little bit of a context, the district has been for some time, and I mean some time meaning a couple of years now, been working on some rulemakings specifically with regard to reducing the relative impact of the refineries here in the Bay Area. We have five refineries. And as Mr. Ned will walk you through for this presentation, I think it's actually very timely because we gave a status update to the Stationary Source Committee on these three rules that Director Gioia just mentioned. And you do have some important public hearings coming up in May and this summer. With that, let me hand it over to Mr. Nudd, and he can give you an update, and we'll be glad to answer any questions you all might have.
Thank you, Chair Niss, members of the board. This is the update that I presented at the Stationary Source Committee meeting on Monday. So I'm going to talk about our recent refinery rulemaking, give an overview of Draft Rule 1216, Draft Rule 13.1, and Draft Rule 1118, then go over the schedule and next steps. Start with the Board Resolution 2014-07, where the Board directed the staff to continue to work on 1215 to monitor emissions, develop Rule 16 to prevent increases, and to develop additional rules to reduce refinery emissions by 20% by 2020 or as much as possible. Specifically, that was for criteria pollutant emissions, 20% of criteria pollutants. So here are the work that we've done recently. In December of 2015, we brought Rule 6.5, which reduces particulate matter from fluid catalytic cracking units. These large process units account for about half of the particulate matter emissions from refineries. Rule 818 reduced volatile organic compound and some toxic emissions from equipment leaks. And once we've implemented that, that will be the most stringent rule for equipment leaks in the country. Rule 1110 reduces VOC and toxics from cooling towers. Again, that will be the most stringent rule of its kind in the country. Rule 914 reduced SO2, sulfur dioxide, from coke calcining operations, and that was in April of 2016. Also in April of 2016, the board approved Rule 1215, which improves our understanding of refinery emissions by improving and standardizing the emissions inventory methodology, requires the refineries to install fence line monitors, which will give us a ground truth for the emission calculations, and simultaneously started the process for enhanced community-based monitoring that will be operated by the Air District. In addition, it requires the refiners to provide us data on their historical and ongoing crude slates, how much crude are they processing, and data about that crude that relates to its emission characteristics. In December of last year, the board approved Rule 2.5, which is new source review for toxics, and that's the rule that we use to ensure that any new facility does not impose an unacceptable toxic risk on the nearby community. Brief history of Rule 1216. In October of 2015, a draft of Rule 1216 was released. We received a lot of comments, and staff decided that in order to have something defensible, we needed to take another approach. So in June of 2016, we presented some options to address refinery greenhouse gas emissions specifically. One is focus on methane. One is to look at refinery-wide combustion emissions. Another is kind of a generalized approach for best available retrofit control technology on refineries, and then a numeric emissions cap. Now, we're calling this CBE's proposal as kind of a shorthand. CBE stands for Communities for a Better Environment, and that proposal was submitted by a number of organizations, not just CBE. So in July, the board directed staff to analyze this proposal as Rule 1216, and then also a staff proposal, Rule 1118. Now, Rule 1118, which I'll talk about in a minute, had a couple of driving forces. One of those driving forces was a lot of concern expressed to the board about cancer and other health risks in refinery communities. The other driver was a change in the way the Office of Environmental Health Hazard Assessment calculates risk factors for stationary sources. So those two drivers led us to accelerate the implementation and, well, the development of Rule 1118. So Rule 1216 limits refinery greenhouse gas and criteria pollutant emissions. So it affects five refineries and three associated facilities. It caps greenhouse gases, particulate matter in two size classifications, sulfur dioxide and nitrogen oxides. And the way it works is it looks at a five-year period. It picks the maximum emission rate for each pollutant in that five-year period and then adds 7% to that. Our analysis indicates that the GHG caps, at least, are consistent with the full production capacity of the refineries in general. Some refineries may be constrained a little bit more. Staff identified in the staff report that we released earlier this year several issues with 1216. It conflicts with state law, state and federal law on permitting. We believe that the court would likely find it to be arbitrary and capricious, and we're concerned that if gasoline consumption continues to increase, the production limits that are a de facto result of 1216 may result in short-term gasoline shortages like we saw in 2015 that in turn resulted in gasoline price spikes. Draft Rule 13.1 is the first rule in the basin-wide multi-facility combustion strategy that the Air District is developing as part of the upcoming Clean Air Plan. And the plan is to take an industry-specific approach with each of the major sources of GHGs. And since refineries are the largest source, stationary source of GHGs in the Air District, we're starting with them. And the way 13.1 works is it would cap refinery GHG emissions at each refinery's current actual full capacity operation. It would account for all greenhouse gases resulting from the refinery operations, including those that come from the production of hydrogen and electricity that the refineries consume. It would require the execution, implementation of cost-effective energy efficiency projects that the refineries themselves have identified in reports to the Air Resources Board. And it would have the effect of preventing the refineries from retooling to process tar sands or similar heavy sulfurous crudes. And it would the operating factor here would be the carbon intensity limit, which will be expressed as their annual greenhouse gas emissions per unit of crude processed by the refinery. Based on the discussions at the Stationary Source Committee meeting on Monday, we thought it'd be helpful to add a slide. So this is a new one that the committee did not see, where we compare Rule 1216 and 13.1. By preventing the refineries from retooling to process significantly heavier, more sulfurous crudes, we believe that both Rule 1216 and Rule 13.1 will prevent significant increases in particulate matter and GHG emissions. Neither Rule 1216 nor Rule 13.1 address toxic emissions. Those are best addressed through Rule 1118. As stated before, we do not believe that Rule 1216 is compliant with the Health and Safety Code. We believe that Rule 13.1 is. Because the because Rule 1216 will not allow refineries to adjust their production to meet demand as allowed under the AB 32 cap and trade program, we do not believe, based on the information we've received from ARB to date, that Rule 1216 is consistent with cap and trade. We believe Rule 13.1 is. And since Rule 1216 would treat the refineries differently and prevent them from doing capital projects under the agency's new source review program. We do not believe it's consistent with state and federal requirements for new source review. Rule 13.1 does not have such a restriction, so we believe that it is. As the previous slide summarized, staff believes that Rule 13.1 meets the GHG-related GOES of 1216, but more analysis and consultation with the stakeholders is still required. We're in the process of scheduling meetings with the environmental advocates and with the refineries to discuss 13.1 further. We also plan to evaluate Rule 13.1 as an alternative to 1216 in the EIR, and this analysis will not impact the schedule for the analysis of draft Rule 1216. Touching on 1118 briefly, this is an area-wide rule. It will require the evaluation of hundreds of facilities, including the refineries. The refineries will be prioritized because they are some of the highest emitters of toxic pollutants. The health risk assessments under 1118 will be conducted by the district using the latest guidelines from the Office of Environmental Health Hazard and Assessment. As I mentioned before, those have been recently updated and are much more health protective even for the same level of emissions. The thresholds for facilities to develop and execute a risk reduction plan has been reduced from its current 100 per million down to 10 in a million. As mentioned before, refineries will be in the first group that are evaluated since they have some of the highest toxic emissions in the air district. We believe Rule 18 ensures public transparency and continuous improvement. Next steps, we're planning a round of workshops in March to discuss 1216, 1118, and 13.1. Also in March, we're going to publish the draft EIR for 1216 and 1118, the proposed rule for those rules, and the draft staff report for those rules. And that will be setting us up for a May consideration of those two rules by the board. For 13.1, we plan to publish draft regulation this month, and so that people will have some time to review it ahead of the workshops in March. We'll provide an update to the Stationary Source Committee in April. We publish the hearing package. The hearing package is the CEQA document, the socioeconomic analysis, the staff report, and the proposed rule. That will be published in May, setting us up for a board hearing in August. This schedule presumes that we'll have to do an EIR for 13.1. Whether that's required or whether we can do a different kind of CEQA document will be one of the things we look at when we're working on it as an alternative to 1216. That concludes my presentation.
Thanks very much. It's extremely helpful to have this, especially for new people. And in addition, calling out the slide, which is the comparison on page 4, which is slide 8, I think is very helpful and probably is going to provoke some discussion as well. Okay, thank you.
Good.
Rod?
Yeah, I was wondering if you could elaborate on... on that comparison slide, without going into elaborate detail, how AB 32 cap and trade versus these rules, you know, how do you find compatibility? Can you elaborate on this?
Yeah, that's one of the things we've struggled with in trying to address the refinery specifically in the context of cap and trade. Is that cap and trade envisions that the reductions will happen where they're most cost effective to happen.
Mm-hmm.
In the most recent draft scoping plan released by the Air Resources Board, they are heading a direction where they're going to require reductions in the carbon intensity of the refining sector on top of cap and trade and on top of the anticipated reductions that they're hoping to get through reductions in the demand for transportation fuel. So in the case of 1216, the information we've received from the ARB to date is that they believe that those hard caps, since they don't allow emissions to increase at any one particular source, interfere with the cap and trade program. In the case of 13.1, we're aligning ourselves with the carbon intensity approach laid out in the draft scoping plan. And under a carbon intensity approach, if a refinery wanted to make a capital investment and improve their production capacity, they'd be able to do that under 13.1, but they would have to fully offset any emission increases, and they would not be able to increase their carbon intensity.
So if we go ahead with 13.1, are we being redundant with CARB, or are we reinforcing what CARB is doing?
The direction that CARB appears to be going is more aggressive than what 13.1 would do. So this would kind of be a bridge towards the carbon intensity reductions that CARB envisions in the scoping plan.
I think it's important to note there hasn't been any public sort of disclosure of a final rule by CARB. I know you may be having staff-to-staff discussions. The board has had a public hearing on its scoping plan that lays out a strategy to regulate emissions, GHG emissions at refineries to achieve either a 20 or 30% reduction in emissions depending by 2030 on refinery emissions, depending on whether cap and trade is in the plan or not, because that's still uncertain. And the staff is still working through the best way to do that and having discussions with stakeholders and trying to, you're correct in saying that that strategy is identified in the scoping plan, and the scoping plan will be up for a vote probably at our April or May meeting. But there'll be a lot of sort of input on it, and it's likely that this strategy will end up in the scoping plan as adopted, but there's still a public process to go forward.
So if cap and trade doesn't happen, if it's not renewed, would this still be an effective strategy would be supported by CARB potentially?
Right. So the options laid out in the scoping plan are options with cap and trade, options without cap and trade, and a carbon tax. If cap and trade is extended, then this particular strategy would seek to get a 20% reduction in refinery emissions by 2030. If cap and trade is not adopted, this strategy is still in, but would need to have a higher goal of a 30% reduction. In other words, to get to the 2030 goal of 40% reduction in GHGs, you need to do more through command and control regulations if you don't have cap and trade. So cap and trade would achieve a lot of reductions, but this strategy would get 20% out of refineries. Without cap and trade, it would seek to get 30%. So the strategy is still in. Just how strong it is will depend upon whether cap and trade is in.
That's very helpful.
That's
Thank
clear.
You.
Okay.
Yeah.
Chair Nissen, if I may add to that. And so the discussion here is about CARB scoping plan, which is a plan, and setting out their their agenda for moving forward. If this ends up becoming a formal part of the scoping plan that's adopted by the CARB board, then they would go through a rulemaking process that would take some period of time.
Right.
It's not a regulation in the scoping plan. It's a measure of identifying how they might move forward, and then it would take them some period of time to develop a regulatory language, so that would be down the road.
Right.
But it sounds like our pursuing this in parallel is in harmony with what CARB is likely to do over time. And if they don't, we're still thinking along common lines.
Right.
Right. I'll just add, the staff has actually been in quite extensive conversations with CARB staff. And we think that this 13.1 is a good companion piece to the direction that's being contemplated by CARB and their scoping plan and their future regulatory agenda. So we think that 13.1 is going to not only be a companion, but also kind of somewhat fill in a needed gap, if you will, with regard to their low carbon fuel standard, their cap and trade program. And that's actually, I think, how they see it as well.
Right. So. And the other point is that I think CARB is working on the CARB executive officer is working on a letter to this air district that sort of sets forth some of its thinking, its official thinking. And I think that's really important to note. It's official thinking and in trying to be helpful about our consideration of all of these rules.
And so Do our other air districts also considering regulation of this kind in the state?
I don't believe so. The only other air district that would possibly think about something like this would be the South Coast, and they've got some air quality challenges that is really dominating their thinking. They are going through a new plan right now, and I think it's to be considered actually on Friday, and it doesn't have a measure like this in their plan.
Thank you.
Think you were next.
Yes, so basically the report out of Stationary Source is that we received this report. Basically, individual members expressed agreement with the approach. There was no recommendation because we don't technically make recommendations, but that's the report out, as this is the approach moving forward.
And once again, John, thank you for having an extended meeting on Monday.
Yeah, it was good.
That I think gave greater opportunity to expand on what their concerns were and what they'd like to see happening as we go ahead.
Which is why we did these updates before the committee, so it gave everybody more chance to give input. Maybe with the chair's indulgence, I was going to suggest that we don't, that given that this is the track forward, unless something changes, that we don't need to have a monthly report to Stationary Source, that we will have a report. So it will not be on the agenda of the next meeting unless there is a change in direction or something new that staff needs to report to us.
Are you requesting weekly?
Weekly? No. we will get an update when staff believes there is a change different from, you know, what the board laid out. So right. It's correct. So it's not on our agenda next month unless there's a need for it.
Right. Our thinking and
because there's a lot of other, frankly, work that Stationary Source and all of us at the district need to do.
Right, Director Joya. Madam Chair, I think from just speaking on behalf of the staff, we would just as soon like to get this done, get this in front of you. And so just to reiterate, as Mr. Nutt indicated to you, we will be bringing this for you at the May board meeting, your second meeting in May. And right now we're moving ahead to have both 1216, which is the proposal to cap the refineries, plus 1118 in front of you, which is our toxics proposal. And I think it might make sense, frankly, to have a Stationary Source committee meeting just before that board meeting, just to reiterate to you if there are any comments that we've seen that need to be incorporated into the proposals that you'll be considering on the, I believe it's the 17th of May. So that would be if the board is all right with this approach. That's what I would recommend, that we don't necessarily bring this back to you every month, because I don't think it's...
So, Jack, you're suggesting that a Stationary Source meeting be held somewhere between the 1st and the 16th of May.
Well, yeah, we had the 15th of May actually in mind, which is that Monday right beforehand. Similar to what we did this week. So it's just really to walk the Stationary Source Committee through what we're seeing. And again, also I'll take it back as direction that if there is any change that needs to be contemplated, that will be the reason why we agendize it for the Stationary Source Committee. But otherwise, I would suggest let us get our work done so that you can consider it in May.
Okay, so that's a potential meeting for the 15th. Okay, Jim.
Thank you, Madam Chair. First I want to thank the staff. I think you really captured what was discussed at our meeting. And, I appreciate the fact that, we're headed in the direction of trying to align ourselves with CARB, which I think is the right thing to do. I know it'll take a little bit more time, but I think we'll have much more meaningful results and stuff that our staff can support. One thing, Jack, I need clarification. You keep talking about something coming back to us in May, yet you say the 13-1 will be much later. How is that going to be an alternative to 1216 if they're not aligned as you bring them forward? I'm confused on that. So give clarity on how are we going to, because our staff has consistently have said you do not support 1216, and I don't think you're going to be changing your mind on that recommendation. But I'm not quite sure how the two of them will be coming before us and how we'll have be making that choice. Because could you give clarity on that?
Certainly. 13-1 is really born out of a lot of work that we've been doing. One, we've been trying to figure out how to make 12-16 work. We don't see how it can, as you indicated. So that is where the staff sits right now. But through the course of our development, we have long thought that we ought to concentrate on the intensity of the fuel being, frankly, delivered and processed in order to be able to make fuels. And so we've come up with a proposal, 13-1, that we think, frankly, addresses the concerns that have been raised to you by the communities. And it would be a good companion piece to the 11-18. And so in our work, we realize it makes sense for us to evaluate that as an alternative to 12-16 in the EIR. I mean, you have an opportunity, right? We're putting together this environmental impact report. It's going to be sent out to the public. We're also evaluating the socioeconomic impact reports. So we saw it as an opportunity to basically include it as part of the EIR to 12-16 as an alternative. But at the same time, we know that we need to be able to have some additional public process and talk to the stakeholders, talk to the affected refinery operations and communities, the local community groups as well, and just anybody else that, frankly, we think will be affected by these proposals. And so that public process, really, we're having a difficult time being able to get that done before the May board meeting. So what you're going to see us do, or at least I'm recommending to you, is that we will incorporate 13-1 as an alternative to the EIR, but that it wouldn't be in time for the board meeting in May. So we will conduct some additional public process. And then, as we've indicated to you, we think that public process will take a few months, and we would then be ready to have you consider it at the August board meeting. Now, I think that's as quick as we can get it. We typically go dark in August, so I don't know if necessarily that will work. It may be a September, but that's kind of the thinking behind it, Director Spearing, if that makes sense.
So do you see a decision being brought before this board on 12-16 prior to 13-1 being developed?
Well, so there's been a lot of conversation by this board about directing staff to be able to formally develop and have it to be considered. And the if you recall, we've had board meetings where we talked about splitting it off and have it considered separately. Ultimately, in the end, the board has made a commitment to have it be considered in the May board meeting. So that's what you see the staff doing here, is that we're following your direction so that you can indeed be here 12-16 on May 17th.
Yeah, I just don't want 12-16 coming forward standalone. I want to make sure that 13-1 is part of that discussion, because it really doesn't make much sense to me that, you know, if we do not approve 12-16, that we have something that alternative is being considered. And so, you know, I just don't want it, you know, I have a real concern about the way this is being presented. I think the Stationary Source Committee was real clear about it being an alternative to 12-16, and the way you're separating the two is a concern that I have. And so I think staff needs to give that some consideration, right, as that comes forward.
John wants to comment on that, yeah, and also I concur with you, Jim, on that point.
So I think you raise an important issue, Jim. I think the way it is under the plan now is the board would get the full presentation and, I assume, completed EIR, Jack, in May. It would have a hearing, and the board would also be updated in May about the status of 13-1, right, and the expected completion date for that. So the board's action in May, the board could take, would have any alternative in front of it, right? It could take no action. It could say, let's wait and get 13-1. So we're not sort of today judging what that action would be in May, other than the board in its deliberative process in May would say, what do we want to do with this information? Where's 13-1? What's the status of that? Do we want to wait for 13-1?
Madam Chair, thank you for your patience. John, I just don't want to be in a position of voting against 1216 without having an alternative. Having, you know, staff repeatedly says there's a better way to deliver health benefits. And I want to make sure that, you know, if I'm voting against 1216, and I'm not saying that I am, but I'm certainly leaning that way, that there is an alternative to delivering those health benefits that we're all talking about that really are not included in 1216. And so, and John, I appreciate the way you've laid it out. I'm very comfortable with that.
Good. Thanks, Jim. Going to this side, Mark, and anyone else on this side? Mark and you.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Wagon yeah. Connect after Ross.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah, managing expectations is kind of crucial here because if we're not going to, this is how we got into the problem with it has to be done in May because we had these expectations lingering for years that something has to be done. And we have this, we're setting ourselves up again for letting down people on expectations because, yeah, if we're going to consider something in May, but 13-1 hasn't even made the playoffs yet, I mean, it's going to be a sad series. So I understand how, you know, we can't just move up. I appreciate the public workshop and aspect of 13-1. And, gosh, if you could just speed it up so it all coincides in May, that would beg the question of why didn't you just speed it all up before? Well, you can't. There's a certain process you have to follow so that it's rock solid. Whatever proposal it is and whatever aspect we're talking about has to be rock solid on the public engagement side. So I think we ought to really be looking at seriously saying, yes, we'll get an update in May, but, you know, we can't really kid ourselves that we're going to make a decision one way or the other if we really have the expectation of looking at something else a few months later. So if I have to be the bearer of bad news that we're probably not going to be making a decision in May, I think we at least need to get that expectation or get that truth out there and not have this expectation amongst the community groups which have been, you know, asking for us to do something that, well, if we're going to have something else, it's going to be a couple months, and to bring them along the process too, see what they say about 13-1 and make it a truly tied in experience rather than fragmented. And then again, facing the wrath of people saying, well, you said in May you were going to make a decision.
And I think the point that Director Ross is making is really important, and I think, Jim, you would concur with that, is that we need that expectation that these will be decided in a comparison, not individually. And I think, John, you and I have talked about that before, and I hope that's the direction that staff is going in. Do you see it that way?
I do. Indeed, that's what the environmental impact report will do. It will analyze the relative impacts of both of these proposals in one document, actually, as well as 1118. And we're going to be conducting the socioeconomic impact analysis as well in that same time frame. As I indicated, though, the board has, for as long as I've been here, has taken public process very seriously, has wanted to make sure the staff has a lot of conversation and discussion with our stakeholders. And I just think we'd be shortchanging that if we tried to, you know, move 13-1 quickly into the May board or to the May timeframe. So I know it's not ideal, but you'll have the analysis of all of them complete, but I do believe there's a public process we need to engage in before 13-1 is ready for your consideration.
Because there is a public expectation, though, one of the things I'd really like to have you find out about is an August meeting out of the question. And I know that you've had the tradition of taking August off, but we have a mixed board here, some supervisors, some city folks, some mayors, and I imagine different people take different times off. We happen to take July off, right, not August. But you might find out so that we can see whether or not, mm-hmm, if necessary, we could have a meeting in August that fit in with the schedules of the rest of the board, at least to, you know, 70 or 80% of us being able to be here.
Okay, that's a good idea.
Mr. Haggard, I'm sorry, Brad.
Yes, I agree with you. I don't want 13-1 done before it's, you know, brought before it's prime time, before it's ready to roll.
Needs to be cooked.
Yeah. I'm going to just repeat what my neighbor, Mr. Haggerty, said is, I'm not wedded to August, to May. Putting them together would probably make the most sense. And let's, what Mr. Ross said, let's look at that as a possibility and get those expectations out on the street right now.
The expectation piece of it, I think, is the most important part. What can we anticipate? Katie?
Listening carefully to all this, what I'm hearing is that, frankly, we're going to know a lot more in May about all three of these rules, right? And specifically around 12, 16, and 13-1, that we won't be ready to make any decisions around 13-1. And I think we've had enough conversation today that's gone out there into the public sphere that folks who are listening understand that there's nothing that makes us have to make a decision in May. It's just that we made a promise to bring 12-16 forward in May. And then the other thing I'm not sure of is, are 12-16 and 13-1, I mean, could they be complementary? Are they mutually exclusive? Is it one or the other or nothing? I mean, and maybe we'll know more in terms of that in May as well. But if you just could comment, Jack.
So relative to 12-16, the staff has been consistent in its concerns over the viability of that proposal.
Legally.
Legally, and just how it would work in terms of our new source review program. There's a lot to the issues that that we've expressed to you on 12-16. So, to the extent that 13-1 in our minds, frankly, is a much more viable option that and addresses the concerns we're hearing, and it has. So that's to that degree. That's why I would suggest that they're mutually exclusive. Frankly, I mean, one we believe works. One is just fraught with too many issues.
And we'll know that in May. And we will have clarity on all that in May with regards to 12-16.
That's correct. That's correct.
And I just want to just double check with Director Broadbent to make sure that as you're engaging with stakeholders around 13-1, that we can have actually that conversation about potentially aligning the schedules in August to get that feedback from them as well, to see what their appetite is for that.
Director Ju, so you're asking about, for example, the community groups that we've heard from and then the refinery community as well. Okay.
And of course, another important piece of information will the scoping plan, the final scoping plan should get adopted by May. So the ARB meeting for that will be, I think, before our meeting. So that'll also tell us a lot about sort of direction as well.
Mm-hmm. Yes, Rebecca. So I just want to be clear at this point, since we've very publicly, loudly promised everyone a presentation of the rules in May, that we're not going to not present them, but we may present them and then say, here they are, we're not ready to take a final vote, we're going to take input, we're going to consider them, and then we're going to come back in August and consider them in context, but we're not going to not present them in May, because I think that people would feel that more unhappy about having been told that we would if we wouldn't. And just the other context I think it's important to keep in mind is that we've been deliberating on all of these rules in the shadow of we're not sure what the state is going to be doing, and therefore if the state does this, we might want to do that. And so it isn't just our own process of figuring out it out. There is also an outside issue that, depending on what happens with cap and trade and other decisions made at the state level, that would have some impact on what it would make sense for us to do. So it's not just our own timeline. It is. There are also external variables. So, I assume at this point we're not doing an action vote, right? The plan is still to keep the May presentation?
Well, I'm going to pitch this to the board. I don't want to presume to tell you that. But I think I've laid it out as to where we're coming from with regard to 1216, 1118, and 13.1. You have made a commitment to the community groups, and I understand that. And so you have said that it needs to be, well, essentially we've committed a May date. So that's something I think you should keep in mind.
Cool. And then my last question is, do we have the list of March workshops in terms of dates, times, locations? It says March, there will be a round of workshops.
Right, we'll be setting those up over the next several weeks.
Well, no, the next several weeks is March. So
no, this is February 1st today.
Well, right, but I'm saying if you want people to come to them, generally the idea would be to have a date
right.
publicized by a month before it. So
yes,
that's what we're planning
we
to
do. We do that, yes, you're right.
So will those be sent to us?
Yes, whenever we set the workshops or open houses, we'll absolutely send that out to the board as well.
Well, and that we set them long enough before they take place that members of the public have a chance to find out
yes.
about them and come
right.
to them. And
we do yeah. work to do that 30 days in advance, and the comment period is also running through that same period of time.
Cool.
Director Kaplan, they're going to be likely in towards the latter half of March. So I'll give you enough time. Correct.
He was first.
Yeah. So my understanding of 1118 is it does impose caps based on health risk for certain pollutants. And I wanted confirmation of that, number one, and two, staff's view of how, if there's any necessary coupling between 1118 and the other rules. In other words, are we going to be teed up to be able to make a decision in May about 1118 at the least?
So, Director Sinks, yes, you'll have an opportunity to, and I would recommend that you consider 1118. So 1118, what it does is it establishes a risk threshold for all stationary sources that are affected by it. And so we're trying to establish a 10 in a million risk threshold for sources here in the Bay Area.
And from any one carcinogen at any particular facility.
So what happens is you take all of the contaminants from a
right.
facility
okay.
and then you conduct a health risk assessment. Actually, the district staff will conduct those health risk assessments. That's the conversation you all have insisted that we conduct them, not the facilities. And what that does is it actually takes all the contaminants and pieces it together, not just one.
Okay.
So it's a very stringent, very health protective standard. We're already getting a lot of feedback on it, you can just imagine. But I feel confident that you'll have it in front of you in May to consider.
And take action upon.
And take action.
All right. Thank you.
John, I want to go back to you for just a minute. When would you anticipate that we'll know more about cap and trade, and where do you think CARB is going to weigh in?
Well, CARB's working on a letter that I think this district's going to get sometime in the next couple of weeks, so we'll see when that letter comes and what it says. The scoping plan is scheduled for adoption in April or May. The cap and trade has to go through a legislative process, so we may or may not know in April or May whether cap and trade has been extended. That's why the scoping plan does specifically say, though, that if cap and trade goes forward, that the refinery direct regulation reductions should get 20% reduction, and if there's no cap and trade, then you get 30%. So the scoping plan is scheduled for adoption by May, April or May. So we'll at least have that plan in place and know a direction. But as Jack says, any specific rules would come later after the plan is adopted. But the plan would identify, and it may have more detail on, you know, whether it's what local actions and strategies and things like that. So at least we'll have May we will have a direction on the scoping plan, I'm pretty confident. I can't say that's up to the legislature whether cap and trade gets extended. We won't know.
So what I'm saying at this point is all this has to fit together.
Yeah.
Because it's a big difference between
right.
20% and 30% depending on the cap
right.
and trade.
Right.
And
yeah.
when that's decided
right.
by the legislature.
And that raises an issue. I don't know, Jack, if you know your rule is not exactly what's in, you know, does not exactly mirror the scoping plans, because that rule's yet to be developed. So, you know, the level of and I think that's going to be something
Carol,
we'll all look for, the level of reductions in any 13.1 are going to be laid out in your rule. Do you have any preliminary thinking of that, of just what the strategy will be?
Well, we can describe 13.1 a little bit more in detail if you'd like, Director Joy, if that's what you're asking.
I'm not trying to prolong this more for my colleagues here. I just, if there was a question about, you know, what level of reduction and whether it's dependent upon with or without cap and trade. That's really the state's call for its regulation. Yours may be different.
Right. I actually just want a little bit of a clarification here. The scoping plan is going to include some direct reductions,
right,
direct what I will call command and control type of regulations, right, because of SB 197.
That correct.
Calls upon
that's correct.
CARB to prioritize right. those measures in addition.
And this efficiency this efficiency concept is what's been identified. Could be other things.
It has, but my conversations with CARB make me believe that it's a suite of measures mm-hmm. that they're contemplating. Mm-hmm. And one thing this board should understand is we'll likely be one of the implementing agencies for those measures, by the way, only mm-hmm. because of the expertise and the fact that we have inspectors on the ground in these facilities and we have engineering staff here that can right. help implement it. So I just want to mention that to you. 13.1 is but one of several strategies. Greg, do you want to just mention a little bit more detail about 13.1 on the reductions associated with 13.1?
Yeah, looking at the energy efficiency approach to improving the overall kind of climate performance of the refineries, some refineries will see like a 5% reduction. Some will see reductions less than 1%. It just kind of depends on where they are with their current design and what opportunities they have. So 13.1 will take a very small step towards reducing emissions. The larger intent of 13.1 is to put barriers in place that would restrict future changes in the refineries to make sure that they don't move toward harder to process feedstocks. And so we see that as a complement to the direction that ARB is going with their industry-specific rulemaking.
Is that?
I can make it a little bit more. I mean, mm-hmm. thank you, Mr. Ned. That's but let me be very clear. What we actually, one of the side benefits of 13.1 is that it's going to restrict, we think, some of the refinery operations here from being able to process some of your dirtier crude. So this, you've heard this concern being raised.
Yeah.
We share that concern. And one of the intents behind 1216 has been, at least been advocated, is that it caps them, caps refineries, prevents that. Well, there's been a whole set of issues associated with that we've explained. And so we've come up with this 13.1 as, frankly, a more direct approach. It actually zeroes in on the intensity of the fuel being processed at the refineries. It just makes a lot more sense to us. And it's an approach that doesn't get hung up with all of our other constraints that, frankly, are the basis of the concerns associated with 1216. So you'll have an opportunity to hear all this. I'm just going to go, I hate to throw it back on you, but only because we live this every day here. I assume you still want to have us make sure that we're ready for you to have at least heard at 1216 at the May board meeting. Is that correct?
I think I hear consensus around that. Let me continue on with this. Karen, you were next, then Carol, then Scott.
Thank you. Just a logistics issue.
And then Mark.
I know scheduling is very, very difficult, but for Contra Costa County, I've not had a chance to talk to Director Joy about this, but one of the other meetings is in the mid-afternoon in Walnut Creek, and I wasn't
talking about the workshops, Karen?
Yeah, for 13.1. It needs to be either in Martinez or Richmond, and it needs to be in the evening, or at least the 5 to no earlier than 5 o'clock. And I really need that commitment because the majority of our constituents are living in those communities.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
So, and it's harder for West County people to get to Walnut Creek at night.
And yeah, I appreciate Karen raised this. Can I just add, I'll let you finish because I was going to add on. I think you raised a good point. There is a meeting in Oakland, which is convenient for some in West County. But Walnut Creek is also not near where there's, you know, a lot of source, although this toxics rule affects a lot of folks. So Martina, if you're trying to get Central County, Martinez would still be easier than Walnut Creek.
I'm just suggesting that it's either Martinez or Richmond in the evening.
Yeah.
And I know you've had one at an elementary school in Martinez. Mm-hmm. That would be fine. Just not middle of the afternoon in Walnut Creek.
So just a point of clarification, Dr. Mitchoff. So you're referring to the workshops for the Clean Air Plan that we're going through right now? And I hear you. We'll have these meetings. Right. We'll have them either in Martinez or Richmond at night. That's what we'll do.
And I know how difficult it is, but it would be nice to at least check with the directors for where you're having it, because it doesn't look good when either I or John can't attend a meeting, and the only reason we can't attend is we have a conflict in scheduling. And I know it just adds another layer of complexity, but I think that's important for all of us to at least be asked to coordinate calendars for the meetings in our various counties.
We would be glad to do that, and we would love to have you come.
Thank you.
And if you do come, we'll put you on the spot and have you talk.
Karen, were you done? Okay, so now Carol, Scott, and then Mark.
Thank you. I have a question about 1118, bullet number one. Hundreds of facilities will be evaluated, including refineries. How will that happen with between staff and timing? I mean, that's a lot of facilities and a lot of work to go into evaluating. Mm-hmm.
Now, Director Groom, you make a very good point. And so internally, we've been gearing ourselves up for this effort, presuming that you'll hopefully consider and adopt 1118 in May. But the board has expressed a desire to make sure that the HRAs aren't prepared by the affected facilities. And so we ourselves are going to rely on our own engineering staff, but also with outside consultants to be able to make this happen for you. And we're going to schedule the facilities as to when they need to come in to have the workflow be managed correctly.
Now, do you have a checklist? I mean, is there a checklist prepared or a series of questions that are asked, or a series of physical things that you want to look at? I was wondering if, you know, maybe we could, not that I would exactly know if it was incorrect, but I'd sure like to see it.
Greg?
If that would be possible. Yeah.
Director Groom, thank you for your question. I put up the schedule for the 1118 implementation. And so the plan is to phase these in. And the prioritization score you see there is the toxicity-weighted emissions. So the facilities that have the greatest emissions will be the ones that we work on first. And in terms of the checklist, the process we're going through right now with the affected facilities in phase one is we're meeting with them individually or in groups as possible to kind of go through the data that we have and to validate that. And the way the process will work is first they'll validate the emission rates, then they'll validate the input for the health risk assessment, and so on and so on. We have sent letters to all of the hundreds of facilities that we think could potentially be impacted by 1118 and invited them to the first round of workshops.
Okay.
We'll do that again for the second round. And what we're trying to tell people is, I think the bulk of these are going to fall into phase three.
Okay.
In terms of the number of facilities, right? So when we talk about hundreds of impacted facilities, probably 650 of those are diesel engine only.
Okay, so what was worrying me is if it's going to take a year or two or more, and we're going to have a May 17 check-in, will we have enough information to have a really valid check-in in May if it's going to be till 18 to complete?
No, Director Groom, really, what's some of the most important information that needs to be in place is for the facilities to understand how they will be able to, what will they need to do, to what strategies, what technologies they need to implement. And that work is being really incorporated into what we call our T-BARCT analysis. I apologize, our term of art here, but Toxics Best Available Retrofit Control Technology. And it's a lot of... it's just a lot of listing of technologies for the facilities to put in place in order to be able to meet the overall risk level. That's all kind of behind the scenes, and we're communicating that with the facilities. And We have been planning that so that it's all done by the May board meeting.
That just to augment what Jack said, that'll all be out by March.
Okay.
Okay.
Good question and good catch.
I was going to say one more thing, though. You know, I mean, I don't mean this in any way to be a criticism, but as we all know, when we do accumulate certain data, we often get asked by our friends who attend our meetings to is it correct? Is it validated? And so I don't want us to rush through something and end up with some data that becomes, in some people's mind, a question mark. So I, you know, really would like it sort of, and it just, I'm just worried about whether we have enough time to do that. But since we've already started, mm-hmm. I hope we do.
We're confident we do. There is just, I will just point out something right away, so it gives you a heads up on the retail gas stations. That's one in which there's some significant disagreement between ourselves and the state and others and the gas station owners about the emission rate that goes on with all this equipment that you and I use when we fill up our cars. And so if we can't figure that out, what we'll recommend to you is that we will come back and amend the rule later, take them out of the original part of it and put them in a future amendment to the program. Okay. And that might be what we do.
Thank you very much for your patience.
Thanks. Scott and then Mark.
Yeah, I really tried to not say anything today, but I just, Director Joy said something that kind of piqued my interest. Chair Ness had mentioned something about cap and trade, and then Director Joy said there's a letter coming from CARB. Is the letter in reference to cap and trade, or is it in reference to the rulemaking?
Sure. I can tell you what I know at least, which is incomplete, but that my understanding it's the letter regarding issues related to the general aspect of cap and trade, these rules, and comments, not necessarily saying do this, do that, but here's some input on all of that. Beyond that, I couldn't tell you more.
So it's an article, not an editorial.
Yeah.
Director Haggerty, I haven't seen a draft or anything yet. So,
yeah. I don't know that answers my question. I guess I don't understand the letter. Why were they giving us a letter about cap and trade, first of all?
Well, it's a letter regarding all. I assume it's a letter. And again, until we get the letter, we don't know what to say because none of us have seen the letter. Other than it's a letter regarding issues.
Maybe I guess I would say, how do you know about the letter then?
Because I'm on ARB.
Okay, so then you know about the letter, so it's got to be more than just the vague.
No, that's comments. All I know, what I'm telling you, that it will comment about issues regarding all of this rulemaking.
Yeah. Okay, so it's then now my interest is piqued. Why is CARB getting involved in this rulemaking to the staff? What has happened?
That's a good question. My understanding is the governor's office and CARB have felt the need to be able to weigh in on this rulemaking. And
How did that happen? I don't understand that because normally they allow the air districts. This is out of the ordinary.
Agreed.
So why are they not allowing us to do our job? I don't know that the air district has ever been interfered with before in rulemaking. Normally they would allow us to make our rule and maybe
that's not
comment after.
This
seems unusual to me. I've been here 20 years, and this seems unusual that, especially this is February. This has been going on for several years. This is February 1st? February 1st. We're going to be rolling this out in May. I think John alluded to the fact that this letter is coming to us in a
I'm
few
told
weeks.
I'm told that it's within the next couple of weeks.
Let's say March. So 2 months prior to the adoption of a rule, they want to tell us what to do? So what's going on here?
So let me relay a conversation I had with our executive officer. Well, I had a meeting to update, so I want to understand it myself because it's not being written by the board. It's being written by the executive officer. So I'll tell you, if you want to hear it from the horse's mouth, I can tell you what he relayed.
Wait, are you being defensive or
no? No, but I'm trying to be accurate.
Okay.
I'm trying to provide information for everybody. First, I have seen letters go out from ARB staff to air districts around the state, not telling them what to do. In fact, I don't think that's the position, but making comments about issues sometimes before local air districts. So first, I have seen those letters, and this would not be a first-of-its-kind letter, because I've seen it go out to other air districts and have been copied on them as an ARB member. Second, it's been relayed to me that the executive officer is not of a position to want to tell local air districts whether they should adopt a particular rule or not, but they want to be helpful, that this is a statewide issue. Climate change, in fact, any local rules that regard, in fact, we actually asked at one time the executive officer to come to this board.
Several years ago.
About a year or two ago to come and make comments.
More like two.
And so I think there's a belief by the executive officer of the State Air Board that these are of statewide, that these programs are of statewide significance, that GHG is a statewide program, and that they want to be helpful. And so, and being helpful is commenting about the larger sort of issues in all of this, but totally leaving it up to local air districts to make their own decisions on rules. So that's the best I know that I can convey to you. And we'll see what the letter says. I think, and we can ask them to come. We can ask them to come when it comes out so we can directly engage, which I think would be good.
Well, Director Haggerty, just been my experience having done this for 30 plus years. Normally CARB weighs in during the rule development process once a rule is out on the street. That's what they normally do. So just not to disagree with Director Joya, but it's a little unusual in my mind that they would comment before. So that's but
the rule well, is actually, out, Jack, actually, the rule actually, is
I'm
out
gonna,
on the
I'm
street.
I'm going to take this one step further. I talked to a local legislator and he told me that there's been a member or a couple members of this air board that have gone up and spoken directly to CARB. So I don't know if anybody wants to speak up here and say they've done that, but I can tell you I've heard there's been meddling.
Well, let me say, there's another board member here who can speak. Everything's public. As a member of ARB, I speak to CARB. That's my role.
I'm not saying you.
I'm speaking. Let me make a full disclosure.
I'm
on ARB, so I get to speak to CARB all the time.
John?
All right.
No need to get paranoid here. I know you're up there all the time.
Right.
And they didn't give me the name. But they told me there has been members up there that have been meeting with ARB separately, trying to get ARB to write a letter. I was told this by a legislator. So something's going on. And when you said the letter, I didn't really believe this, but when you said the letter, I can tell you now, something's rotten in Denmark. And somebody should stand up and say, I did it.
Well, whatever meetings occurred between directors and state, the comment about letters, in fact, Jack, you've been in contact directly with Richard Corey, also seeking input. So let's be clear, there's been ongoing discussions with you
that's
representative.
His job.
Right.
But you know what? For somebody to go up there and say they're speaking on behalf of this air district is wrong.
Yeah.
Certain people that speak on behalf of this air district.
Yeah.
Okay?
I don't know
let's
why
be
you,
really
you're
clear.
Getting into all of this. There's a letter
because,
coming.
You know what? Let's be
helpful.
Transparent.
Yes. So
you brought the letter up. I didn't.
Yeah. Well, I think it's fair. It's important to understand that there's a letter and Jack's aware of that. So, Jack, let me be clear. They wanted to look at you said the rule wasn't out on the street. At least two of the rules are on the street.
So
1118 and 12-16.
There's a long-standing practice between the Air District and the state that a month beforehand, I think we normally would provide them that opportunity to comment.
It's actually required by statute that we send a copy of the rule that we're going to propose for adoption 1 month before the hearing.
So that's actually not until April, actually. So just to give you an idea, and that is kind of a long-standing practice between staff to staff. And as Mr. Munger indicated, it's essentially in state law that we're required to follow that process. So it's a matter of just professional and work that we communicate back and forth between CARB staff and the district staff. I think you all expect us to do that.
Let me just chime in for a minute, though. I think Scott has a point. Has somebody attempted to influence ARB? I think we should find out when and if a letter is coming. It has now been aired that a letter might be out there, or I'm also hearing it might not be out there. Am I correct?
We don't have anything in hand.
So I don't know whether this is hearsay at this point or
the executive officer told me.
Maybe these are, what is the new word? Alternative fact?
No.
So I think the important thing is, rather than having this long discussion about who did what, is, Jack, can you find out, is there a letter coming, and when is it coming, so we can just put this to bed this morning?
Yes, I'll find that out, Madam Chair.
I think that, and Scott, that's what I can offer at this point, is, Jack, to find out, is there a letter, is there something to this, or did the letter have nothing to do with anyone who's sitting here whatsoever, other than John?
Okay. Can I say one other thing? I actually think a letter may be very, whatever a letter we get could be helpful in the big picture of just understanding all the issues. Why are we afraid to get a letter from a state agency on climate change?
I don't think that was the issue, though.
Right.
So could we go on to Mark?
Thank you. So, Mr. Broadbent, what gives you the qualifications to be Supreme Court Justice? Okay. I'm sorry, wrong hearing.
My mother was thrown in jail.
But in an effort for harmonic convergence, could we, and especially we do have some new board members, and welcome to we're not always, and we didn't even get into whether the letter should be a text or maybe even a tweet, but what might help for not only board members, and I'm not underestimating the intelligence of anybody up here, but it is, even I have to think it through, what the difference between 1216 and 13.1 is. And when you were explaining how under 13.1 that they wouldn't necessarily be able to go to dirtier and heavier crudes, well, they could make that choice, but it would be at a cost of production because they would only be allowed to emit so much greenhouse gas. Is that kind of a...
Yes, Director Ross, that would be accurate.
Like if you're going to make lemonade, if you want to make lemonade to sell, you only get so much water, and if you want to use nasty lemons, you can only sell.
Right, and that's something we'd have to look at as we develop the rule, whether a mass emission cap is kind of a backup. Because as you say, if a refinery is designed to process a certain type of crude and they go outside that design window, typically they can't produce as much, so their emissions actually go down.
Yeah, I think it would be helpful to have some type of distilled, if you will, version that shows the difference to the average person that would say, well, if we go this way, this is what happens. This is what the limitations are. If we go this way, it may limit the production of gasoline.
I think I can cover that in like.
Well, I don't want you to do it. I think something should, like the checklist you had earlier.
Right.
I don't need an explanation today, but I think down the road it might be helpful for a more visual and distilled version. And as I've just heard, maybe something, CARB's comments or what CARB is doing. And how these things all intertwine, because I think unless you're really enmeshed in this, it's really kind of confusing to see what the difference between, 1216, 13.1, 1118, unless you're totally immersed in this. And I think not only as a refresher for people like me, that were sitting up here, but for the public, so that we know what we're talking about, what we're promulgating, what the choices are, and how they interact, and what the actual effect would be should we go down each path. Just as somebody from the Public Engagement Committee looking at this, this is starting to get a little bit, you know, very, very dispersed and very technical for most anybody to follow, unless you're doing this day to day to day. And that's it. And Mr. Broadbent, if you do want to become Supreme Court Justice or head of the EPA, I'll vote for you.
I looked around. I think the only person left is Rebecca. And if anybody else wants to speak, see if particularly you can get Dave's eye. Director Kaplan.
Thank you very much. In terms of, and I'm not necessarily asking you to do this today, but in terms of preparing for future presentations on this, to be able to address the issue for each of the rules in terms of addressing global environmental impacts versus fence line community impacts, and just both, I guess, for those of you who are new and not, you know, one of the issues that has caused the community groups to keep raising this is that their goal isn't just to reduce total average pollution, but rather they're concerned specifically about the health impact pollutants on the communities adjacent to the heavy emitters, such as refineries. And so to address in terms of each of the rules, not only what do they reduce in total, but how do they help or not help the folks living closest to the heavy polluters. And then in terms of 1118, you mentioned that it covers a huge range of facilities, but that a very large portion of them are just diesel engines. Is that, am I recalling correctly?
Right. If you, let me see if there is. There
which
is.
Are for diesel generators, is
so
that? Or
you have some facilities, I'll just list them for you, like hospitals, for example,
right,
that'll have a bank of backup generators.
Yes.
When you model that out, they can actually be a fairly significant risk. So, if I can ask Jamie or our director of engineering.
Significant portion of the facilities that would need to do this assessment.
Well, so Director Kaplan, the board has said we want the staff to be doing this, so we would be doing that assessment for them and selling them back. This is our understanding of your risk. Here's your controls. Follow a plan. That's how the process would work.
Okay, and so, and this, again, I'm not asking for us to make a decision about this today, but one of the concerns has been that 1118 will cover so many facilities that it will be really hard to work out. And if there is a whole chunk of them where we're just talking about diesel generators, we might want to consider that separately. As I've been learning, one of the ways to deal with that is to run them off of biodiesel, which dramatically mm-hmm. reduces particulate matter. And so maybe there's a solution that is very simple in terms of some sort of regional, you know, biodiesel access plan or something for these generators, where we're not having to make each hospital, who may not be an expert in diesel engine particulate emission reduction, figure out case by case by case how to do what is in fact the same thing for all of these facilities, where if swapping a biodiesel is the easiest solution, maybe for all these hundreds of people, we don't want them to each have to go come up with a plan. So again, it's something I just want to put out there. I'm not necessarily expecting us to make any sort of decision
right,
today,
right.
But I would want the number of mm-hmm. plans and the complexity of the plans being made under 1118 to not have, like, the paperwork process become so overwhelming that undermines the getting to whatever the emission reduction strategy is.
Right, right. Let me ask our director of engineering, Mr. Williams, how many facilities under 1118 are just diesel engines only?
So it's roughly half that we're projecting, so 400 to 500 of those. And that's just in terms of number, not in terms of the significant risk. And what you raise is exactly why we've sort of proposed this phasing and breaking out both the diesel backup generators as well as the retail gas stations, because we think as sort of industry-wide or source category-wide, approach to those is more appropriate.
Okay, I am looking around at this point, and I'm going to ask John to wind up on his report for stationary source, and then we will go on to our next item.
So this was a good full discussion of what we discussed at stationary source and more, so that's good. So the direction is, I want to make sure we're summarizing what we've all said, is that...
Let's see if anyone wants to...
Yeah, well, okay, all right, well, it is... You have the cards. Is there any? Are there any public speakers on this item?
Madam Chair, I have six.
Okay. You get to call
those. So, John, before you
do
the finale, I think we would like to hear from the six who are here. And could you read them off? And, Marcy, if you read them all at once, it would be very helpful if they line up and we're ready to go. Thanks.
Tom Lewis, Richard Quiroz, Stephen Yang, Ron Espinoza, Mike Miller, and Paul Adler.
Are there any others in the audience that are likely to want to speak? Just put your hand up so we get a general idea. One more. Why don't you come down and get in line, and then you can make out a card. Okay, it looks to me like there are four of you, am I correct, that are still here? Okay, in that case, unless it turns out to be a great many more, you can have 3 minutes if you need it. You'll be encouraged not to take the whole 3 minutes if you don't. So if you want to come up to the mic, identify yourself, and just go in any order you line up.
Good morning, board members. My name is Stephen Yang. I'm with Chevron. California's AB 32 is reducing greenhouse gases in the state. AB 32 has implemented reductions of millions of tons of carbon offset products, which are protecting forests, recovering livestock methane, destroying ozone-depleting substances, and implementing mine methane capture. AB 32 also requires lowering the carbon intensity of the fuels produced in California. We are producing fuels that include renewable diesel and low-carbon intensity ethanol. Nevertheless, also recognize that it is impossible for AB 32 or any Bay Area regulation or any combination thereof to have any measurable effect on climate change. The Bay Area as a whole emits less than 0.5% of the world's greenhouse gases. California refineries make up less than 0.1%. Even if all of California stopped emitting greenhouse gases, there would be no impact on climate change. I believe you understand this, but I want to make sure we all have our eyes wide open. Any strategy that the Bay Area or California leads to reduce greenhouse gases relies completely on the following or cooperation of national governments in order to have any meaningful impact on climate change. And this has yet to be seen, even 10 years after the passage of AB 32. Let's combat climate change, but let's be realistic about what local regulation can achieve and how that might put our economy at a disadvantage. Chevron's concern is not whether to fight climate change, but how do we do it? Our concerns when it comes to greenhouse gas regulations are whether the regulation will make a difference and whether all industries are treated equally. This latter point is important because even though corporations own refineries, each refinery must justify its own existence economically, just like any branch of a franchise. The more localized greenhouse gas regulations are, the greater the handicap we have competing in the world's markets. Hence our fear of being regulated out of business, seeing what might be nine regulations hitting our refineries in 2 years. We are asking that you address these concerns in any future greenhouse gas regulation. Thank you for your time.
Madam Chair, if I can just say one thing, because there was a comment made that there is not cooperation with international agencies. That is just flat wrong. The Minister of Environment for Quebec met with the state last week. They are joining a program with the state, Minister of Ontario, because Quebec's already in it, and California's been working with China. So I want to be clear, because as a member of ARB, there has been substantial progress between, and this is not meant to be a dialogue, I just wanted to clear the record. There's been substantial progress between a state program, China, Ontario, other countries, to develop programs together. And that is happening. So I just wanted to be clear, because there was a comment that there's been no progress, and that's just wrong. And the governor has also said the same thing. I'm repeating the same thing that the governor of California has said.
And let's stop it there rather than having a dialogue. Next person, please.
Good morning. My name is Richard Kidos. I've worked for Chevron and live in Pinole for 28 years. I'm a proud volunteer in Oakland for over 22 years. I'll be brief. Proposed Rule 1216 would most likely cause the following. Constrain the availability of transportation fuels, which would limit travel from our vital airports and raise the cost of many goods and services. 1216 is not aligned with air quality objectives or the district's process for rule development. I urge the board to follow the science, follow the advice from your experts, and follow your staff's recommendation on 1216. Thank you for your time.
Thanks very much.
I thought there was an order, so I apologize.
It doesn't matter. Marcy's very clever at sorting them through.
I'm so used to getting on airplanes and make sure you're not number two or three or whatever. anyhow, thank you for allowing me to speak with you. I am Ron Espinoza. I am a resident of Martinez, and I am here on behalf of the United Steelworkers of District 12. We have the 11 western states, where I am the sub-district director, and that is for the state of California. Our union represents tens of thousands of workers throughout the state, including refinery workers at Chevron, Phillips 66, Shell, and Tesoro here in the Bay Area. I am here today to speak about proposed regulations 1118, 1216, and what I just learned today about 1301. Overall, USW District 12 supports the goals of continually improving the environmental and public health in the Bay Area. Our union has a long tradition of supporting public policies that protect the air we breathe and the communities we live in. Our union has forged long-term relationships with community and environmental partners that have tremendous value to us. USW is committed to the board's rulemaking process and to working with other stakeholders and with the board and staff of the Air District to develop the strongest policies we can. The health workers and our community depends on it, the health of workers and our community. To that end, we submitted detailed written comments on these three rules on Monday this week, and I didn't realize there was going to be 24 people or 20 people here, so I got about six that I'm willing to. We didn't send them to the board. How you doing, Mr. Ross?
Don't worry. We can share. Thank you.
There you go. Thank you. So I'd like to make I'd like three quick points. First, we believe Regulation 1118 can make a real difference in our communities and workplaces, reducing emissions from toxic air contaminants like diesel particulate matter and benzene. This is a terrific move for the health of everyone in the Bay Area and particularly positive for poor communities of color that are hit worse by toxic exposures. Second, we support both the climate and health goals of Regulation 1216, but our position on this rule has evolved based on input to the board from the Science Advisory Council and the Air District's technical staff. We are concerned that the possible unintended consequences of this rule might outweigh its positive attributes. Again, our concerns are detailed in our written comments. We are committed to this process, and we pledge active engagement going forward with community and environmental partners and with the board. But for now, we urge the board to pump the brakes on 1216 until the concerns of these experts have been addressed. Third, we are intrigued by 1301, but have not had a chance to conduct a detailed analysis. Here, too, we look forward to working with community partners and with the board to assess this rule based on its merits. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Next person, please.
Good morning, Mr. and Ms. Directors. My name is Mike Miller. I'm an operator at the Phillips 66 refinery, and I'm the president of the United Steelworkers Local 326 out of Rodale, California. United Steelworkers 326 and our sisters and brothers at Local 5 are united in support of the United Steelworkers District 12 comments. Mr. Espinosa gave you guys a copy. I actually had a copy mailed to all 24 of you and all of your staff. It went out
Tuesday
morning. I
did receive it, and I'll bet everyone else did.
So if you haven't received it, you shall receive it shortly. As I said, we're in support of U.S. District 12 comments submitted on Monday this week to the Stationary Source Committee, and we stand behind the comments made today by District Subdirector Espinosa. Our members have deep ties to the community. We live in the community. We raise our families in the community.
And we know that air pollution reduces air quality of life and long-term health to our families. Our members also need a safe workplace. We do not want to be exposed to toxic air contaminants like benzene that can cause health risks. But we know from your Science Advisory Council that benzene is emitted from leaks in the process piping and equipment. That's why we are supportive of Regulation 1218, which will bring down emissions of toxic air contaminants from facilities all over the Bay Area. The South Coast Air District did this years ago. To be clear, when the Air District reduces toxic industrial emissions, you protect the community and you protect the workers. With Regulation 1216, as Brother Espinosa noted, our union has a long-standing history for climate protection efforts. We were involved in the early discussions around 1216, but we share the concerns of the board science advisory panel and the board staff. We think it's time to address those concerns and get this right, rather than pushing through a regulation that might not achieve its important objective. We're going to look closely at 13-1 to see if it corrects some of these problems. Again, we'll be working with our partners and with the district to make this proposed regulation as effective as possible. I'd like to thank all of you for the opportunity to speak with you today. And like I said, we're going to make a commitment to address these concerns and to work with the district to protect the community, the health of our workers, and the jobs at these local facilities. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Miller.
Good morning, Chair Niss and members. My name is Bob Brown. I'm with the Western States Petroleum Association here in the Bay Area. And WSPRA and its member companies have significant concerns with draft rules 1216 and 1118, which we outlined in detail in a rather extensive letter in early December. So I'll let that speak for itself. But with respect to Rule 1118, as has been discussed, it'll have far-reaching impacts on hospitals, gas stations, manufacturers, power plants, and many small businesses totaling more than 1,000 in the Bay Area and many of them in your respective districts, which underscores the importance of having a sound process to consider these facts and science behind the risk thresholds in a reasonable time frame. The district recognizes that 1118 is more stringent than most other air programs being implemented in California to address toxic emissions, but it fails to explain or justify the basis for regulating so much more stringently at 10 parts per million to develop a risk reduction plan. There must be a balance of authority to control air pollution, and the district acknowledges in last month's Air District how much progress has been made in the last 20 years with the necessity of the rule. The rule should take into account the additional reductions that will occur as WSPA members implement the additional controls imposed over the past year through the district's refinery strategy. A risk reduction threshold for a risk of 25 per million was reported to the board initially in July of 2016 and later removed from consideration without any analysis or justification. The district needs to assess the feasibility and cost effectiveness of 25 parts per million threshold, which is already a significant move and consistent with South Coast, along with the incremental costs and benefits of going from 25 to 10. And with respect to 13-1, we look forward to working with the district staff and the board as that rule develops. Thank you.
Thank you. Next speaker, and then I think a last speaker, unless someone else is waiting.
Thank you. My name is Paul Adler. I'm with Phillips 66 Refinery in Rodeo. And I do want to compliment what Mr. Brown had just mentioned, and that was just for staff or potentially the board to just help us understand the basis regarding the threshold number limit. Right now, we, as you guys are aware, there's a threshold limit of 100 per million for the cancer risk. We were told that if we get it down to 25, that could be acceptable, okay, rather than an unacceptable risk according to OEHA. But then all of a sudden you're telling us, okay, instead of it being at 100, we're going to bring it down to 25, and then we're now asking for 10. Between 25 and 10, we need to get a little more rationale. And I would hope that you guys would too, because if you look at the different entities, and we're not just talking refineries, we're talking 1,000 almost facilities, that's what your constituents and the small business owners are going to want to be able to say is, what is the rationale from going from 25, which you had already stated in July, all the way down to 10? And if the staff can provide us that, or you guys in May with that rationale, we would greatly appreciate it. But the numeric threshold right now is what's causing, I think, a lot of anxiety out in the community. And I hope that you guys are aware of that and that you'll be able to explain the rationale in that threshold number in the near future. Thank you very much.
Thank you. And our last speaker is...
Thank you again, Tom Lewis from Martinez. I would just like to read an excerpt from a white paper called The Future of Workers, Future for Workers, a Contribution from Black Labor. It's from May of 2016. It can be found on the Coalition of Black Trade Unionists website. The question of the environment frequently divides organized labor. It is less about climate change denial. Instead, it revolves around the counterposing of jobs versus the environment. As a result, unions have either remained silent in the face of environmental disaster, or they have joined hands with employers in advancing projects that are anti-ethical to human existence. In order to work, one must be able to breathe. In order to live, one must be able to avoid extreme weather, floods, and pestilence. Yet with the 97% of climate scientists agreeing with the danger and reality of climate change, we nevertheless have lethargy on the question in the ranks of organized labor. The environmental crisis has a particular impact on communities of color. The establishment of toxic facilities near neighborhoods, the failure to clean up toxic sites, and the dangers inherent in rising ocean levels on communities near the shoreline all have disproportionate impacts on the communities of color. There's also the phenomena of toxic dumping, which frequently occurs in the vicinity of working communities, end quote. The balance of it, as I say, can be found on the Coalition of Black Trade Unionists website. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, and thank you to those of you who have spoken with us this morning. John, I'm going to ask you if you would wind this up, and we'll go on to our last item.
Sure. So thank – yes, Jack, go ahead.
Yes, Madam Chair, you've heard now several speakers ask, what is the reason why we're proposing a 10 in a million risk? And I just thought I would give you a heads up on that. Currently, we have a program where we require health risk assessments from stationary sources. It's referred to as our AB 2588 program. And if the risk from that facility is at 10 or greater, they have to notify the public. And right now the action level is 100 in a million. They have to undertake steps if they're over 100. So what we have done for you in this proposal, and you'll be considering it in May, is establishing what we believe is an appropriate health risk management standard at 10 in a million. We think that's appropriate given the latest with regard to OEHA and basically a number of findings relative to toxic air contaminants. And frankly, it also shores up the inconsistency between when a facility has to notify the public and when they have to do something. So you'll hear more about this in May, but I just thought I would give you somewhat of a response back from the comments you're hearing from people. Why are we establishing a 10 in a million standard?
Thanks, Jack. I appreciate that, and I'm sure everyone else does.
Madam Chair, just real quick. You know, Jack, I had made a request to get a list of all these businesses we're contacting. I have not received it. Can I get that list?
Yes, I'm sorry. Okay. We haven't done that. We'll do that.
Yeah, I think it's important to send to all of us just all the impacted facilities. That's important for everyone. And you're covering this in the open houses, too, I take it.
John, any last comments?
So, okay, so just to sum up, as we heard our thorough discussion today, is that the staff is continuing to move forward with three rules, 1216 and 1118, in which the analysis will be complete by May and presented to the board in May. What the board decides to do at that meeting is up to the board in its discretion. It's not obligated to take action. It can support or not, or take no action. And that rule 13.1 is also under development, and that is not, we will get an update on that in May as well, but that's not scheduled for a full complete analysis and presentation back until the summer. Is that sort of a very simple summary of the approach?
That's my understanding of the conversation that's occurred here, right. And I am going to just make sure that you all give me that as direction of the board, because right. I have learned through this process it's real yep. good to get direction of the board, and I don't want us to be second-guessing you.
So does that summarize, we want to make sure, does that summarize the current direction? Yes? Yes?
Yes. I'm seeing okay. nods, so I think that's a good sign.
Thank you.
Okay, that winds it up for John. And Ms. Barrett, you wanted to speak?
Yes, on that list that has been requested with the names of the companies that are going to be affected by it as well, I think it's important yes. to put on there what kind of effect it's going to be. They're not going to all be equal. Correct. And I think it's really important to point that out. Thank you.
Can you do that?
Well, actually, let us take one step further. Let us break down that list by your area. How about that? So you know what facilities in your city or county are going to be affected by 1118. That's what I think you're asking for, Director Barrett, right? You're asking for who's going to be affected by it.
Well, I just don't want, if there's going to be a multimillion-dollar fix in one place and a generator upgrade in another, I don't want those to be conflated as being equal impacts. That's my point.
Okay.
And Madam Chair, can I follow up on that? Because that's an excellent point. Not only the list, but has there already been a letter that's gone out? Can you include that? I'm assuming it's the same letter, and that goes to what Ms. Barrett's talking about. And I understand it may have just been I'm going to use the word generic. I don't mean that as negatively as it sounds, but we're considering Rule 18, and your facility could be impacted, you know, please be aware of this. Could we just have that cover letter? That would be helpful, too. Thank you.
Can I just a question?
Let's make not this summary. The last, okay?
So, we heard also from at Stationary Source from some of the publicly owned treatment works, you know, the wastewater mm-hmm. and water agencies, about issues for them on 1118. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, obviously, we want to be sensitive. That they also pose risks as well as any other private facility, but we want to be sensitive and understand, and I know that maybe doing some type of special outreach to the publicly owned water treatment and wastewater treatment plants.
Yes, Director Joya, we've actually already talked to them, and we're trying to schedule a workshop just for the wastewater treatment facility operators. And really the issue there is they need time to be able to build into their investment plan controls that may need to be implemented at their facility. And, of course, you're talking about public agency to public agency, both trying to achieve public good. So it's really just a matter of working with them to make sure that that their needs are met through the time frame for the implementation.
Yes, go ahead.
Jack, could you share with us offline when you have those meetings or those workshops set up with the various wastewater facilities specifically?
Will do.
Thanks.
Will do.
Good. Thank you, everyone. Thank you. Good, lively conversation. And thank you all for staying. I appreciate that. I'm my goal this year will be that our meetings don't go so long, because when they do, I know they interfere with the rest of your day. So I'm going to give you a quick update on the Ad Hoc Building Oversight Committee, and then if there are any other public members to talk on non-agenda items, would you let Marcy know? There's no card as yet, and otherwise we'll end up with board members' comments if there are any. So the Ad Hoc Committee did meet this morning, and we approved the minutes from November 16. We reviewed and discussed the staff presentation for our facility right here in the transfer of funds. The committee recommends that the board approve the authorization of the transfer of $9 million from the general fund reserves to complete the purchase of our portion of 375 Beale Street. That is the only recommendation that came out of this morning, and with that I would move that we approve the Oversight Committee's recommendation. Any questions on that? Any comments? Rebecca?
Yes, thank you so much. When we were at our prior meeting in the South Bay, one of the issues that arose is that some of the elements that were promised to this agency with the building have not yet been provided. For example, the electric vehicle charging stations. And so one of the things we discussed is whether those would be conditions of this escrow and that otherwise we might never get the promised thing. So I was curious if there was any update on that as part of the committee's action or recommendation or just what's going on.
Well, I don't know how much Jack will share with you, but there's less than full cooperation in a number of areas.
Yes.
He is continuing to work on that with great interest and zeal. However, perhaps if any of you choose to put pressure on any of that group that can make a decision, that might be a good idea. But I think some of this is not lack of ability, but lack of mobility in this case. We can't seem to mobilize that group.
Well, and I think that's a fair representation, which is why I would think it would be appropriate to condition the $9 million on those things being completed, because people have been calling, begging, asking for months. But if it's literally a term of the escrow, if it is a legal requirement for them to get the $9 million, then I bet it'll happen.
So let me look at either Jack or
whomever. If I can.
Jack, Madam Chair, could I just comment before? Because Scott and I both sit on BATA.
On MTC.
On MTC. And it's not the way it's being portrayed. Nobody's been sitting on this. Nobody's been ignoring it. There's been a lot of complications. And our staff has assured us that contract is moving forward. It's a high priority. They've made that commitment to BATA. We relayed these concerns. And you shouldn't condition anything. This is a partner that we've been working with. It's a partner that has really been very accommodating to this air district. And to portray it that way, I think, is just not really appropriate. And BATA is fully committed to installing those. The number increased. And so the whole process of how this came about is just not the way it was originally presented. And so, but Scott may want to comment, but BATA is fully committed to getting these in as fast as possible. And I believe several of the contracts have already been awarded.
I'm looking to your comment, Scott.
I agree. Bah.
It appears that there's a tale of two agencies, so I it would be difficult to know where in there.
I would only submit that there's, you know, look at this facility. It's a beautiful facility. There's a lot going on still. There's been a lot of people moving in. I think it was reported just the other day that there's over 1,400 people working in this building. BCDC is in the process of getting ready to move in. There's just a lot going on. I mean, give these people a chance.
So if I can, Madam Chair, the RFP has been issued. A contractor is about to be selected. So there's some additional changes to the garage as well that we're working through. And so you'll have chargers here, I think, over the next several months installed. And okay, some of you drive, so you need to use them, I understand that.
I know it's frustrating, Rebecca. I will have to take the word of the two MTC members sitting here that they are moving expeditiously as possible. It's probably that qualifier that makes the difference. So with that finishes. Is there any dissension on accepting that report? And if there is none, could we go on to the finale, which is any? And you said, Marcy, there was no one who wants to speak from the public?
Correct. I have no cards.
Thank you. And any board member comments? As we close down, and once again, thank you for staying.
Wait.
No, I won't dismiss you yet. Oh, yeah. You're okay.
Yeah, as it is brought to my attention that, you know, if we don't have any reports to read out at the next meeting, it could be awful quick. Is there any thought to...
Would you like to cancel it?
I don't want to come over here just to talk about a letter. I mean, there's nothing else going on next or 2 weeks from now, correct?
The staff has suggested canceling the February 15th meeting. So what I would suggest is that we move to do that unless there is anyone who is really opposed. Is there any opposition?
Let the staff decide.
Pardon me? Okay. So Scott's made a good suggestion. We will notify you within a week as to whether or not there will be a meeting on the 15th. So any other comments, suggestions, so forth? Anyone need to give a speech?
No.
Okay. If not, thank you all for staying, and we will see you on the 15th, and if not, at the beginning of March. This meeting is adjourned.